Our reading this morning is from the book, What Happened to You? By Bruce Perry. And I want to say that this doctor and this book was given a lot of time on the Oprah show. And Oprah is a big influence on American culture with her book club, with her lifestyle. And so as you might choose to pick up this book, it's slim, it's great reading, What Happened to You? You'll maybe find out more about Oprah as well, and it doesn't mean it's not a good book. He's Dr. Bruce Perry, What Happened to You? Conversations on Trauma, Resilience, and Healing. Our major finding is that your history of relational health, your connectedness to family, community, and culture is more predictive of your mental health than your history of adversity. This is similar to the findings of other researchers looking at the power of positive relationships on health. Connectedness has the power to counterbalance adversity. May is National Health Awareness Month, National Mental Health Awareness Month. Our religion does not make a point of honoring all of those National Awareness Months, but mental health is an important part of life, with spirituality its close companion. You can be somebody who is deeply spiritual or not at all and still have a robust mental health, but they're closely linked because a crisis or confusion regarding either one of them may impact both. Famed author and therapist Mary Pfeiffer, she wrote about Ophelia, young women who you ask them at the age of 10, what do you want to be, what are you good at, and they've got a long list, and you ask them 13 or 14, they don't think they're good at anything. So she wrote about the Ophelia complex. She also wrote about old people in the U.S. She calls it another country because it's what it feels like, aging in America. Her name is Mary Pfeiffer. She's a Unitarian Universalist. She said that church is where therapists go to meet their patients. Now, of course, boundaries and ethics might make that be a place where therapists give referrals, but she meant that we are all concerned one way or another with our mental and our spiritual health. Today, our talk will use some acronyms, and I don't want you to get hung up on them when they come around. So first, I want you to know that DSM is the book used for mental health diagnoses. From the website of the American Psychiatric Association, it's defined as the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, 5th edition, text revision. It features the most current text updates based on scientific literature with contributions from more than 200 subject matter experts. The revised version includes a new diagnosis, prolonged grief disorder, and it clarifies modifications to the criteria sets for more than 70 disorders, and has the addition of internal classification of diseases, symptom codes for suicidal behavior and non-suicidal self-injury, and it updates, I'm trying not to read too much of the soup, it updates to descriptive text for most disorders based on extensive review of the literature. So if you've ever picked up a copy, if you're not a mental health professional and you've picked up a copy, you can understand some of it, but it's definitely clinical and based in gathered experience, clinical diagnosis. Here's the part that I'm most interested in for this version 5. It includes a comprehensive review of the impact of racism and discrimination on the diagnosis and manifestations of mental disorders. The manual will help clinicians and researchers define and classify mental disorders which can improve diagnoses, treatment, and research. So the DSM, we'll talk about it more, but it's the actual manual that I'm talking about when I say DSM. Another acronym is for the National Association for Mental Illness, or NAMI. NAMI and the DSM. Both are resources for anybody who thinks that you might be neuro-spicy. I just learned a new word about habaneros, if you're hot and different. Maybe they need talk therapy. Maybe folks who, I'm saying they, maybe we, those who are neuro-spicy, need talk therapy or medications or both, some type of help, because something about them makes them feel uncomfortable or different. Self-diagnosis usually begins when we ask a general practitioner if they can think of a reason that this or that might be happening. It isn't really about a bunch of people going immediately out to a psychiatrist. It usually starts with your GP. You have a physical symptom that you might be thinking is linked to something else. You feel sleepy and run down, even though you got sleep. They advise a clinical diagnosis. When does the tiredness hit hardest? Do you notice anything in the overnight hours? So you observe like they asked you to. You journal. And because you know, when you've journaled, when you've looked at everything, you find out that you have anxiety. All of the check marks line up. Now, because you slowed down and you paid attention, you filled in the blanks that make you think maybe you have anxiety and maybe you're going to go back to that doctor and look for a diagnosis. Well, you also, in journaling and taking care of yourself, discover sleep apnea. Rarely is a physical or mental diagnosis issued alone. This is all an example. I'm not talking about anyone's particular life. This is how we all decide to get mentally healthy. We look at body and spirit and decide. Rarely is a physical or mental diagnosis issued alone. Usually it's at least in pairs, if not clusters. Maybe if you care for your sleep apnea, your brain will not register that you're in danger and the anxiety might go away. Or maybe you simply acquired general anxiety along the way and you'll need to learn how to deal with it whenever it makes its presence known. The DSM gets revised in real time and it studies the change in treatments. When enough changes mandate a whole new edition, they issue one. Currently, people are using the fifth edition. Keep in mind, and this is just my layman terms, the DSM is a growing journal that both changes itself based on input, but it's also used as scripture for diagnosing mental illnesses, including recommended treatments. So it's very give and take. The DSM is a growing tool. Not too long ago, homosexuality was considered a mental illness in the DSM. In every new edition, diagnoses have been added that did not previously exist as diagnoses in the DSM. For example, the American Psychiatric Association updated its terminology from gender identity disorder in previous editions to gender dysphoria in the DSM-5. Have you all ever heard either of those phrases? Okay. This shift was made to reduce stigma, shift focus away from the transgender identities, and emphasize that the diagnosis is about the distress caused to people who have transgender identities, and by the disconnect in how it's treated rather than in the identity of being transgender. It's a fine point, but it makes a difference. When more trans people felt safe to come out and be visible, the topic of gender dysphoria became almost common discourse. Granted, I have a person in my home who is transgender, and I am in a profession that pays attention to these things, but I am telling you, I've heard that phrase in grocery stores. I've heard gender dysphoria talked about as common discourse. When some public or outward action is made regarding awareness of a particular diagnosable condition, like there's a movie made or a celebrity publicizes their diagnosis, it becomes a blessing and a curse for those living with it. With more trans people coming out, dominant culture jumped in to normalize and learn about that identity. Or some came out to jump on writing anti-trans legislation and spreading false stories. It became an awkward and yet valuable time for trans people and those who love them. We're still in that strange place, as we will be with any new edition of the DSM. When Rain Man, the movie, shed light on autism, with its hero being autistic in a very particular way, it was good for autism awareness and terrible for individuals with autism and their families and caregivers who weren't like Rain Man. Same with Jack Nicholson and OCD, and Russell Crowe and schizophrenia. The list goes on. Awareness is good, and each person is still an individual. So it's not great when people think they know things about you because of having been seen in a movie. So let's just kind of keep that in mind, that I know I've done it. An idea comes into my mind, and then I'm looking at somebody who I believe might have that identity, and I want to show what a great supporter I am, right? Check yourself. Mental health and spirituality are linked. Always have been, always will be. For one thing, disorders that plagued many of our ancestors could have been handled, now we know, with herbs or well-developed coping mechanisms, except they were understood at the time to be caused by demons. As our understanding changes, so does medicine. And the reverse is true also. Chicken and egg examples abound in mental health scenarios. If we're already being judged or even cast out because we have some uncomfortable characteristic, and we could take a pill to help align with the typical way of thinking, would we take it? Think of how many children in Sunday schools got disciplined and judged, maybe some of y'all, for being disobedient or irreverent, when ADHD would not have let it be any other way. The times we live in will not only shape us, but the cultural relationship to mental health will as well, and sometimes really deeply. Think about hoarding. We only recently came up with that phrase because it is so common. Hoarding is often found among people who lived through the Depression and its time of great scarcity. And this is simply a cultural thing, but many people carry shame about it. It's being studied now, another example, it's being studied now, whether people born in the 21st century actually don't have the same drive to procreate as previous generations because of concerns over both unchecked violence, like shooter drills in school, and climate concerns, raising ethical questions about what kind of world their children would inherit. Our culture may have actually changed the brain chemistry of people being born. Cultural changes can affect mental health in entire communities or populations. Many people want to find the cause, the blame, for a diagnosis of atypical mental health. Keep in mind, when speaking of the state of a person's mental health, there's not really healthy or normal as much as there is typical or diverse. Also, some conditions run in families, or they're caused by generational repetition. Looking for a cause or a blame is never a happy journey, leaving one feeling satisfied, and it's not really suggested. We all know why this thing makes us uncomfortable. Ugh. And as stated before, not very many conditions come alone, liking to develop from and around each other. So learning to deal with a new diagnosis of yours or a loved one can feel multi-layered and overwhelming, because it often is. when one finds oneself in the midst of a new situation where you have to develop resources or take meds or both, or you have somebody you care for and they're leaning on you while trying to adjust to this change, it is imperative to know that you're going to be okay. Your minister says so. And they're going to be okay too if you're taking care of them. There may be changes and things could be different, but entering the world of being mentally atypical, neurodiverse, what we say neurospicy, it has its silver linings. First, there's always help. It gives you a great reason to forge new relationships. Others with your type of condition will be around. If you speak up, you're going to find out that somebody else has it too. And there may even be support groups. Another silver lining is that therapists are magical, and therapy is the best gift you can give yourself. There's books, art. There's renewed interest in research because you're your favorite subject. All of this is easier if we understand it as dealing with something atypical rather than trying to fix something that's broken. One of the leading books for lay people who want to think about mental health and current trends is called What Happened to You. I quoted it at the beginning. It tells us that we all, no matter how typical or atypical we are, have to let things pass through the undeveloped part of the brain before it can register in order for you to give an appropriate response. If we have a lot of past traumas or fears or whatever have you gumming up the works, you might not be able to get to that next level. That's where we get misunderstandings and arguments and more. A person who can process quickly and get back to being regulated after some bumpy words is considered typical. Those of us caught in the unregulated zone, the lizard brain, are atypical, and we've been told that we must work harder to right the ship. And that's for every single encounter that we have all day long, all week long. When kids today are exhausted, after not exerting themselves outwardly, you can trust that they are exhausted, medicated or not. From the book, What Happened to You, the author talks about how other countries, how other disciplines look at the American way of medicating for everything. He says, "The elders were very patient with my curiosity and gently amused at my Western medical model formulations of disease when I asked how they handled depression, sleep problems, drug abuse, and trauma. They kept trying to help me understand that these problems were all basically the same thing. The problems were all interconnected. In Western psychiatry, we like to separate them, but that misses the true essence of the problem. We're chasing symptoms, not healing people." I think that's where church can come in. With the entire culture we live in being fraught enough to give each person their very own personal anxious thoughts, it adds loneliness to the mix as well. So not only do you have these things that are bothering you, but with no one to share it with, there's isolation and loneliness. Connections fight loneliness and isolation for a stronger mental health. Even in crisis, prior generations had the shared experience of all hiding under their desks together from an outside enemy. I mean, the desk was never going to protect us from nuclear war, right? But it was an outside enemy, and we all did it together, while today's next shooter might be our neighbor. It is untenable for a healthy organism to thrive in such uncertain circumstances. And it is no wonder that today's children are so very medicated for so many mental health maladies. We clergy have responsibilities in our continuing ed to keep up on current trends and what people might be dealing with because of medication, because of lack of medication, and more. Some clergy, like Reverend Liz over at the Episcopal Church, are doubly blessed to be clergy and therapists. The rest of us, like me, can offer pastoral care before recommending further professional help. It's always a privilege to journey with you on that. So if anything I'm saying today touches something in you that makes you want to talk to me this week, I'm ready for it. It's always a privilege to journey with you. Mental health and spirituality are always connected. So now I want to share this new movement with you that I will be curious to see if you picks up on. I got these things that started getting dropped into my feeds, and I had to check and make sure that I wasn't being scammed. I wasn't. From a journal out of Harvard Law School, the sub-article entitled A Good Example, UCC Pioneers. UCC is Main Street, United Church of Christ. The United Church of Christ is the only denomination currently crafting a specific proposal regarding psychedelics. UCC Psychedelic and Entheogenic Medicines Resolution was informally presented at their 2025 General Synod. Work is proceeding at the grassroots level. Shrooms, they're talking about mushrooms. UCC Church is studying this. The primary intention is to destigmatize psychedelic medicine in the context of church so that people seeking treatment using psychedelic medicines aren't judged or vilified and can find support from their pastor and local community integrating these parts of their identities. Going on with the journal, the Reverend Molly Basket, a leader in this initiative, told the author, "If the church is serious about access to high-quality mental health care for all people as a part of addressing suffering, it's incumbent on us to, number one, be well-informed about the science and understand how the misinformation-disinformation works around the issue, and two, advocate for legalization so all people have access to these life-saving therapies." I'm telling you about the data. I don't know anything about this. I find it fascinating, and I have not found anything that UU is doing in this direction yet. The article closes with, quote, "As the legal landscape continues to change, the need for churches to directly address medical, spiritual, and recreational use of psychedelics is growing more urgent." I take it seriously, but also I worry, what is UCC doing that we don't know about? And my closing thought is that so many diagnoses in the DSM are there because capitalism has been the dominant culture. We must operate in such a way to be productive and keep feeling happy about being productive for this way of life to work. Having ADHD, for example, or many other situations, and being distracted is not really something that needs medication or correcting, except that it makes it hard to be an obedient, productive student or worker. For some, the atypical brain chemistry makes them feel uncomfortable, and that's the best reason to seek help and to seek medication, for us to feel better about ourselves, not just to fit in. Lately, after COVID, capitalism as a driving force is not working as well as it used to. The rent is so high and the work is so hard to find, many Americans, especially young people, are going without insurance. They're going without meds. And soon, we're going to see effects of that on our life. The DSM added that the effects of experiencing racism and oppression are its own problem. And this speaks to us of staying apprised of what other problems are going to crop up that we're going to need to be aware of to hold people in community. Maybe the next edition will have notes on what it does to a person to live under authoritarian law, because it is changing us, to be sure. I hope that we all hang in there. I hope that we keep coming back to the same problems and looking at them differently and with new eyes. I hope that we keep trying to understand each other and not be so judgmental of ourselves and of others. I hope that we keep working toward our own health in community and in understanding ourselves in context with community and in building. Church is a great place to learn to deal with this. Mary Pfeiffer said so.